Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our brand new Substack newsletter and website at letitrollpodcast.com. We've got archives of every episode sorted by genre, era, guest, co-host, and miniseries. It's also a great way to support the show if you can afford it. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Nate hosts a Let It Roll telepathic interview with the still living but unavailable Andrew Lou Goldham to discuss his memoir, Stoned. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today I'm not joined by anyone because we're doing yet another telepathic interview. This time, my guest, or not guest, is Andrew Lou Goldham, the manager of the Rolling Stones, and this discussion is going to be about his first memoir called Stoned, a memoir of London in the 1960s. And this book basically tells the story of how a 19-year-old ended up becoming the manager of Britain's second biggest band in the 1960s and made them, I mean, they didn't have to be Britain's second biggest band. Andrew Lou Goldham made the Stones as much as the Stones made the Stones. And he tells that story in this book. It's told as an oral history, which is an interesting way to do it. A lot of it is quotes from Andrew Lou Goldham, but when they interviewed other people for the book, they just took their raw quotes and put them in paragraph or sometimes pages at a time. And they even took, when needed, quotes from other published books. And there's a few notes from the James Felch book that we discussed the other week, but he's got some details that I missed last time that Oldham picked out from the firing of Ian Stu Stewart, the sixth Stone and the original pianist of the Stone. And it's pretty key to the story. But to start out, Oldham is very similar in a way to Marianne Faithfull in that he was the child of a single mother who had immigrated from Central Europe. I believe she came from Austria. She was of Jewish stock, so plenty of reason for her family to get out of Europe in the 1930s. And she was a nurse. And in the 1940s, she got pregnant, and the father was believed to be a guy named Andrew Lug, who was a Dutch Texas airman who was in the American Army Air Force. And he died flying over Germany in the 1940s before Andrew was born. So that's where he got his name, Andrew Lou Goldham, Oldham being his mother's last name. He was fortunate enough in that she had a long-term relationship with a married man who helped her financially and helped her raise Andrew. She's a very resourceful woman as well and worked and did other things. But she managed to put him into public school, which is the opposite of what it sounds like. It's public school is British private schools. And so he got to go to some pretty fine educational institutions where he learned an abiding hatred for the British upper classes, but also learned how the games worked. And a big part of becoming the manager of the Rolling Stones at age 19 was that by the time he was 16 and through with public school, he had a pretty good handle on how things were done. And he it's just a pretty amazing story of initiative, because by the time he's 15 and 16, he's going and knocking on the door. He's like going to Noel Coward, the famous British playwright and songwriter's house in the morning, and knocking on his door and just asking for advice. He did that over and over again with basically anybody who was in show business or the fashion industry, which were his two main interests, and just introducing himself and finding out how things worked. He's also one of these people that was basically inspired by film and created his own life around movies. And there was in particular, a Tony Curtis and Burt Lancaster movie called The Sweet Smell of Success that was an inspiration for Oldham. And in that movie, Tony Curtis plays this guy, Sidney Falco, who is, according to Wikipedia, a, quote, morally bankrupt Manhattan press agent and a frustrated fringe player. And Burt Lancaster, the great Burt Lancaster, plays J.J. Hunsaker, who's a super powerful radio host and newspaper columnist. And it's based on the guy, Walter Winchell, who is an absolutely towering figure in American pop culture in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And, you know, basically, Lancaster's daughter's dating somebody who's a musician, and he doesn't want the guy to date him, and he doesn't want his daughter dating this musician. And Tony Curtis is morally conflicted, but ultimately helps blackmail and ruin the musician so that the daughter is safe from this awful jazz musician. But the over the top, depictions of the way the press worked was a huge inspiration to Oldham. He was also very inspired by Espresso Bongo, which was a movie about the British pop scene before the Beatles, primarily about a manager named Larry Parnes, who managed Billy Fury and Tommy Steele and had a whole, and Johnny Gentle, who toured with the Beatles. Had a whole stable of boys that he groomed in every sense of that word. And so Espresso Bongo is a pretty classic vintage late 50s British New Cinema telling of that, starring Lawrence Harvey. And Lawrence Harvey was also somebody who was a childhood hero of Oldham, because somehow Oldham had become aware of his management and that he had these brothers, the Wolf brothers, who managed Lawrence Harvey and kind of took him out of the British studio system and managed him independently. So Oldham's learning all these lessons very early. He's also inspired by Johnny Ray, who I need to do an episode on they did a good discussion of him on Cocaine and Rhinestones. But Johnny Ray was the biggest pop music figure in America between Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley. So he's kind of the king of early 50s pre-rock and roll. He was very influenced by gospel and other black music, but he's not quite rock and roll. He's still very much in the jazz pop vein, but he pushes the limits. And he was also pretty flamboyantly homosexual, although closeted, and Oldham was very interested in ambiguous sexuality and things like that, and was just drawn to Johnny Ray like a magnet. And he you know, as soon as he gets himself out of school, he's hanging out with people like Peter Meadon, who goes on to become the first manager of The Who. Unfortunately for Meadon, he renamed them The High Numbers and put out two singles that he wrote himself, I'm a Face, and I can't remember what the other one was called. And they flopped, and he was gotten rid of and kind of became an early drug casualty. But Oldham got the benefit of hanging out with Meadon, who was a couple years older than him, and learning Meadon's approach to the scene and to music. And Meadon, for his inability to succeed on the highest level, was a visionary, and Oldham learned a ton from him. And his first big job was with Mary Quant, who becomes the famous designer of the miniskirt and is the reason that King's Road in London became a fashion center in the 60s. So Oldham's just one of these guys who has a nose for where the action is, and he got in there and got after it and made himself invaluable to Mary Quant, and then suddenly quit to takes a jaunt to Europe, as one does when you're a precocious teenager, and comes back to London and then works at Ronnie Scott's, which is a famous jazz club. And it was the first club that solved the issue of how to get American jazz musicians over to Britain, because of the there were feuds between the British Musicians Union and the American Musicians Union that prevented it, made it very difficult to bring a whole band over in the 40s and 50s to cross the Atlantic from either direction. And Ronnie Scott's figured out that they could bring over lead musicians and have their own backing band, and it would be workable. And so Rahsaan Roland Sanders and many other great jazz musicians played at Ronnie Scott's, and that becomes an incubator for people. And Andrew's right in the thick of that. And then he becomes a PR guy, which is his true calling. And almost immediately, he's working for Brian Epstein and helping to promote the Beatles. He was one of their first promoters in London doing that. So he is Johnny on the spot. And another one of his clients in this period is Phil Spector, the legendary independent record producer and songwriter from America. And Phil Spector has enjoyed quite a bit of success at this time. And I think we've talked about in other episodes, the British were much more into songwriters and producers. And so when somebody like Doc Pomus went to England with his partner Mort Shuman in the early 60s, they were celebrated, and they were on TV shows and interviewed in newspapers. And this was very different than the way backroom figures in the music industry were treated in America. And Phil Spector was one of the first people to break through that in America because of things like Tom Wolfe's famous article in Esquire about him, calling him the tycoon, the terrible tycoon of teen. And Spector is a guy who made himself the most successful guy in music. I think he had 15 top 10 hits in 18 months or something like that, all as an independent producer and record label owner. By the time he's 23, he's on the absolute pinnacle of the music industry. And let's go ahead and hear a song. This is the Rolling Stones backing up Phil Spector as they sing a ditty called Andrew's Blues. I've picked the least obscene Porsche 30 seconds of the song. It's totally filthy. I highly recommend listening to it on YouTube. But this is Phil Spector singing about Andrew Oldham, Andrew's Blues. And that was Andrew's Blues, sung by Phil Spector with Andrew Oldham and Mick Jagger pitching in, backed by the Stones. They recorded that song at the same session they did the Stones' third single, Not Fade Away, which was their first really massive British hit, their cover of the Buddy Holly song. But back to Andrew Oldham's story. You know, 18 years old, working for Brian Epstein and the Beatles as a press agent, hobnobbing with Phil Spector, and picking Spector's brain. And Spector explained a lot to him, some of which would be very important for the Stones. The most important thing was Spector told him, look, if you ever manage a band and you sign them to a record company, make sure you sign a production deal. Rather than signing the band directly to the record company, sign the band to your own production company, produce your own records, and lease the tapes back to the record company. Very advanced stuff for the early 60s. And the kind of thing that is why Phil Spector was a self-made millionaire by the time he was 21. He understood how the business worked, and Oldham soaks all this in. And while he's got this semi-successful career in PR, he needs to rent office space. And so he gets referred to a guy named Eric Easton, who is a old school showbiz booker who also has a nice living because he rents organs to Butlin's holiday camps. So this guy's a very old school conservative guy. He was only in his mid-30s, but at the time, especially to an 18-year-old Andrew Oldham, seemed ancient. But they have this, you know, pretty loose business relationship where Andrew's just renting a cubby in his office. And around this time, he gets tipped off about the Rolling Stones. This reporter, Peter Jones, is going to write the first major London newspaper piece about the Stones. Long before they have a record deal, before they've ever been on the radio, it was very unusual for a band to get press attention even then, before they have those basic elements. But the Stones are drawing such big crowds. And were leading a transition away from trad jazz, which had been the dominant club style in London from the late 50s into the early 60s after rock and roll and skiffle had faded out. And trad jazz is being replaced by R&B, spearheaded by the Rolling Stones, as well as Blues Incorporated and Cyril Davies and a couple of others. And so he goes to see them and later admits that, you know, it was only because it was convenient for him that it was on his way home, that he didn't have to change tube stations. It's the only reason he bothered to go see it. But he's on his way to the club and he says, opposite the train station was naturally enough the station hotel. The Rolling Stones, and note the apostrophe, it's not the Rolling Stones yet, it's the Rolling Stones, I'd been told, would be playing in a room that had an entrance at the back of the hotel. I crossed the zebra, meaning the crosswalk, and headed down a long alley. On my right was the station hotel building, and on my left, the British rail lines running further southwest and back north again. For the first few strides, I was alone in the alley with the sound of my mind and my footsteps. Halfway down the path, I saw that I was not alone. There were two figures ahead of me, one with the back to the wall, the other facing, arms against the wall. I got closer. They weren't discussing, they were arguing. A girl was against the wall, and a boy was pressing his point. As I passed them, I tried to be invisible, looking away from them, but not quite. The three of us acknowledged each other, I by picking up my pace as I passed by, they by pausing their argument. He gave me a look that asked me everything about myself in one moment, as in, what are you doing with the rest of my life? His lips looked at you, seconding that first emotion. He was thin, waistless, giving him the human form of a puma with a gender of its own. The girl was a bridge to reality. They were both very earnest, hurt, and similar. Pale skins, brown hair, and flashing eyes, and both very attractive in their similarity and heat. In the shadows of the pathway, I wasn't sure who was mommy and who was daddy. And it turns out that's Mick Jagger and his girlfriend, Chrissy Shrimpton, whose sister Jean Shrimpton was Britain's top model at the time. Anyway, he goes in and he is impressed immediately by the whoosh of hundreds of waving hands, dancing feet, and heaving bodies. So the place is absolutely packed. And immediately Oldham admits he wasn't familiar with the kind of R&B that they're playing. Like, they were into Chicago blues, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, stuff like that. R&B to Oldham, R&B to me had been Elvis's A Mess of Blues and a bunch of interesting Chess 45s released on Pi in the UK and were of no interest to me. They were of much more consequence to this Michael Philip Jagger, who regularly petitioned Pi to release more Bo Diddley records. The stuttering beat spoke of sex the instant it started a little dance in my heart. And so I'm going to go through and read his descriptions of the Stones. He says, the Rolling Stones were six who became one. Three were backed against the wall. On the left, one Bill Wyman on bass. To his right, a large amp I'd only seen in ads and Charing Cross Road store windows. He stood like the statue who became a celebrity, concentrated, nonchalant, picking his instrument in an upright, shoulder arms, army drill position. He was gaunt, pale, almost medieval in a way. The drummer appeared to have been beamed in, and it seemed you didn't want so much to hear him as feel him. I enjoyed the presence he brought to the group as well as his playing. Unlike the jacketless other five, he had the two top buttons of his jacket done up meticulously over a just as neat button-down shirt and tie, unaffected by the hot weather in the room. Body behind Kit, head turned right in a distant mannered disdain for the showing of hands waving at 78 RPM in front of him. He was with the Stones, but not of them. Kind of blue, like he'd been transported from the evening from Ronnie Scott's or Birdland, where he'd been driving in another Julian Cannonball Adderley time and space. Julian Cannonball Adderley is a jazz musician who, ironically, Brian Jones named three of his illegitimate sons after Brian Jones. Charlie was the one and only, all-time man of his world, gentleman of time, space, and the heart. His rare musical talent is an expression of his bigger talent for life. I'd just met Charlie Watts. Backstage right was the odd man out, sometimes on piano, sometimes maracas. He had a Popeye torso, a William Bendix jawline, and a bad Ray Danton haircut. He cared for his little, quote, three-chord wonders till the day he died. As time went by, he would pay me this compliment. Andrew Oldham? I wouldn't piss on him if he was on fire. Yes, the real deal, the sixth stone, Ian Stewart. The front stage three took in and gave out from stools nicely opposite to their striving audience. From stage left, black as night, hacked hair, maybe baby-hacked face atop a war-rationed baby body channeled into his guitar. This hollow-cheeked one affected an alchemic exchange in cool hand heat with himself and turned on a dime with alacrity. I wasn't sure, though, which was which and who played what. Such were the six-string exchanges between Keith Richards and the incredible blonde, hulking hunk stage right. Brian Jones's ugly, pretty, shining blonde Barnett was belied by a face that already looked like it had a few unpaid bills with life. His head, having foregone a neck, slipped straight into a subliminally deformed Greystoke body, undeniably one half of two with one great guitar sound. Yet of all the six, Brian was the one whose eyes darted around the room, wanting to suss the reaction right now, and not able to wait for the acclaim or applause between songs, although he bathed in that too, like somebody having sex, rolling over, smiling, and saying, "Next time it's your turn, our own Diana Barrymore." Finally, center stage front was the boy from the railway towpath, the hors d'oeuvre, the dessert, and the meal in between. On that tiny stage, when I took in the Stones' front line, I saw rock and roll in 3D and Cinerama for the first time. There had always been a succession of ones, Elvis, Johnny Ray, Eddie Cochran, and more. Then at the New Victoria Cinema, I finally saw an act on stage that didn't cheat. The Everly Brothers sounded like their records, the crickets backing them superbly. Blah, blah, blah. So he's talking about the Everly Brothers, and then he says, "Mick's voice was the first of many things that struck me as I watched Brian, Mick, and Keith work with and in spite of us and each other. It wasn't just a voice. It was much, much more than a rendition, a mere lead vocal. It was an instrument, a declaration, not backed by a band, but part of the band, their decree. Mick moved like an adolescent Tarzan, plucked from the jungle, not comfortable in his clothes, probably that night a drip-dried, turn white shirt and loose black string tie. Take six midweight truths around a body that was still deciding what it was and what it wanted, a positive question of opposites. I'd never seen anything like it. They came on to me. All my preparations, ambitions, and desires had just met their purpose. It was a feeling of all the elements falling into the right place and time, catching all the dualities. The music was authentic and sexually driven by the three on stools and the bottom end behind them. It reached out and went inside me, totally. It satisfied me. I was in love. I heard the anthem of a national sound. I heard the sound of a national anthem. I heard what I'd always wanted to hear. I wanted it. It already belonged to me. Everything I'd done up to now is a preparation for this moment. I saw and heard what my life thus far had been for." And that's, that pretty much says it all. The dude recognized his moment and seized it. He's just a 19-year-old kid. He doesn't even have an agent's license. He's not old enough to sign a contract. So he doesn't even talk to the band that night. And he goes back first thing he does is calls Brian Epstein, whom he's been working for, and offers him the Stones, and Epstein passes. But Steph tells me it's time to cue. So let's go ahead and hear, and this is going to seem like a non sequitur, but this is Jean Pitney, "That Girl Belongs to Yesterday." And I'll explain why I picked this song when we come back. And that was Gene Pitney doing a song he called "That Girl Belongs to Yesterday." It was written by Mick Jagger and Keith Richards and produced by Andrew Lee Goldham. It was one of the first songs that Oldham sold after he bullied Jagger and Richards into becoming a songwriting team. Probably his greatest contribution to culture, even bigger than the things he did for the Stones, like coining the phrase, "Would you let your daughter marry a Rolling Stone?" That song, I believe, was originally called "Something's Just Stick in Your Mind," but Pitney changed it around and basically rewrote the melody and the whole thing, but he let Mick and Keith keep the whole song credit. Pitney was another one of these clients of Oldham's, who Oldham did press work for him while he was touring the UK. We talked about Pitney having an affair with Marianne Faithfull on that same tour. or on a tour shortly later after Oldham discovered and signed her. But anyway, Oldham goes back. First thing he does is calls Brian Epstein because he works for the guy and he figures he owes him the right of first refusal. But as he expected, Epstein was too busy with the Beatles and Jerry and the Pacemakers and Cilla Black and all these other bands from Liverpool and passed on it. So then Oldham goes to his office landlord, Eric Easton, and they cut a partnership. And the two of them together go back the next week to Station Hotel and introduce themselves to the Stones and cut the famous deal that makes the Stones the Stones. But there's a couple more moments. This is something that I should have caught from James Felge's book, Nankering with the Rolling Stones, or Felge's Stones, which is how it's referred to here. But Oldham quotes him in the book and saying, when the Stones finished playing, Eric returned to his home and Andrew joined us for a meal. How many of you are actually in this band? There's six of us all together, said Mick. Six or seven? I thought there were seven. There's actually six in the band. You, he counted, pointing at each person. As he said that, something clicked in my mind, and I looked at him and thought, he's going to say the band is too big for a pop group. There are too many members compared to other bands. He's not going to be interested. And so even though Oldham was interested in the band as a whole, Felge immediately picked up on what's going on. And Keith, there's a quote from Keith Richards here very early on that explains that Andrew already had his vision for the Stones and was pitching them on it immediately. Richards said, Andrew saw immediately that there's room for more than one act. He was looking for an alternative to the Beatles because he couldn't work for them anymore. I guess Andrew's mind would work this way. If Liverpool can produce the Beatles, what can London produce? Liverpool was much further away from London than it is now. There were no streets, no highways. I mean, Liverpool is, as far as London is concerned, it's Nome, Alaska. And so he immediately had a vision of the Stones as the alternate to the Beatles, the bad guys to the Beatles, good guys, and sold them on that from the beginning. And then Oldham describes the first meeting that he calls it a mixed doubles match between him and Eric Easton. And on the other side of the table was Brian Jones as the leader of the band and Mick Jagger. When Andrew first approached the band, he went up to Charlie Watts first and asked, who's the leader? Who should I talk to? And Watts pointed him straight to Brian Jones. And then his description of the meeting is pretty fascinating. The first thing they do is ask if there's anything contractually preventing the Stones from signing a management deal. And Brian tells them nope, that they've been working with this guy, Giorgio Gomelski, who's going to go on to become the manager of the Yardbirds and a pretty important secondary figure in the British pop scene. But the Stones had been informally managed by Gomelski, and they had what Gomelski thought was a pretty close friendship and a shared vision of popularizing the blues and rhythm and blues. But they hadn't signed a contract, and Brian Jones and Mick Jagger were very quick to sell out their friend Giorgio Gomelski. And he doesn't mention another contract they had signed, but we'll get to that in a minute. He also says that, quote, I was fascinated by Brian Jones's position as group spokesman and leader. A short year later, when my knowledge of the structure of groups had increased, i.e. I was an expert, I realized almost every group had a manager until they had one, meaning that until a group had decided on management or management had decided on them, and the real deal was in to help one and all up the ladder to money, fame, and fuck everything that in sight that moves, aka sex, drugs, and rock and roll, a member of the group either found himself in or elected himself to the position of frontman, sounding board, keeper of the cash, and checkpoint Charlie in the world in which the group lived. Then two things usually happened. Either said temp manager got no joy from phoning dozy drummer Dave five times to make sure he got to the gig or rehearsal on time, and got no spurt of power from holding a few quid for a few hours and welcomed getting back to just the band and the music. For the other cast of managers in waiting, things weren't quite so simple, and they started to get a little fucked up. They'd enjoyed holding all the cards, even for a few minutes, from the rest of the group. They relished the importance of telling the other anxious band members what had transpired during the day and what might happen the next week. They were the first to hear good news, and they were the bearers of needed data, heeded by default. The rest of the band gave full attention to the spokesman, though if he thought about it, he knew actual management was needed for the dreams and reality at hand. He could never get over the loss of power, that moment of secure importance. For some, it dimmed the pleasure of all the good things to come. So Brian Jones sat across from Eric Easton and I and began the long goodbye. And then there's an interesting quote from Linda Leach, now known as Linda Lawrence, because she married Linda Leach is Donovan's name, her husband. But before she was married to Donovan, she was Brian Jones's girlfriend. And she's I think we've mentioned that Brian moved out of the Stones flat in Edith Grove to move in with Linda Lawrence's parents in the suburbs. And it's fascinating. To get her perspective on Brian Jones, it says, to me, Brian was the leader of the band because he seemed to organize and arrange everything. It seemed like Mick had just sort of come in and they were still kind of testing who was and who wasn't playing with them. It seemed like they were trying Mick out at the time and it seemed to work. So it went on and on. She also talks about how neat and tidy Brian was and how filthy the other boys were back at Edith Grove, which is pretty hilarious when you have the accounts of James Felge and the other Stones and know that Brian was the king of filth. But she also talks about how Andrew and Brian didn't get on. I think it was because Brian was such a strong character himself and was such a strong person. Although he had insecurities, he knew what he wanted. Mick and Keith were younger. They didn't quite know, so it was easy for Andrew to manipulate them. At the time, Brian was trying to write his own stuff and integrate into the music. He'd be back at my parents' house writing songs in the middle of the night when he'd come back from a gig. When Andrew came into the picture, it seemed like the focus started going on to Mick and Keith. There were lots of arguments. I'd hear Brian on the phone with Andrew going back and forth about who's doing what. Anyway, Brian wasn't too pleased about this Andrew Oldham character coming into the picture and taking over. Mick and Keith got on really well with Andrew, so that created a distance between those two and Brian. Because I was pregnant, Andrew and the other Stones didn't really want the press and public seeing me. Let's see. Brian was quite a smart boy and he was very clean. The other boys liked to make a lot of mess. The kitchen was disgusting and I used to bring up food for Brian from my home. So that's the classic. But then immediately Brian's nature comes to bite him in the ass because they go to sign their agreement with Oldham and Eastman. And at this point, Brian and Mick signed the management agreement, but then Brian reveals that he can't sign the recording agreement because he's already got a contract with IBC Studios. And this was the studio where Glenn Johns worked and recorded a 5-song demo with the Stones. And in return, they were signed to IBC for a year. But let's take a quick sponsor break. When we come back, I'll reveal the first of the lies that Brian Jones was caught in by Andrew Oldham.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus Meal Plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
And so when Jones revealed that he had signed a recording contract, the Oldham immediately seized with rage at this bastard that had signed him to gotten him to sign to a deal and then revealed he couldn't sign the full context of the deal. So they created an elaborate plan where Brian Jones went back to IBC while Glenn Johns wasn't around. The managers of IBC were completely clueless. They didn't know who the Stones were from Adam. And Brian explained that he had an opportunity to join a group that already had a recording contract and was signed, and that he was going to break up the Rolling Stones and didn't want anything to stand between him and the opportunity. So he said his parents had given him £90 to buy the Stones out of the contract. And that £90 had come out of Eric Eastman's pockets, and Brian handed that over and got free. There's also an exchange between Mick and Keith and Brian and Andrew and Eastman from that first meeting that I think is telling and I need to get to. And this is Andrew describing the meeting. He says, he quotes, "Please tell us what it is you think you could do for us, Mr. Easton," Brian said, allowing a nod in Mick's direction. "Look, lads," Eric began, "we'd really liked you, and both Andy and I would like to manage your careers. We'll do the very best we can, but I have to make it clear we'll make a real go of it, but we're not making any promises about anything to you." "What does that mean?" entered Jagger. "Good one," I thought. "I like this, Jagger. Four words to the point and not cock of the run like Jones's 'what do you think you could do for us' routine." And then he explains, Eastman explains what he could do for him. And Oldman then has a pitch. And then Brian is back in the game with, "Eric, what is it about us that you think is good? What about us did you like, is what I'm saying." "Oh, cry me a river." Even Mick squirmed. Then it was my turn. "What we like is that you've got it. I don't know what it is, but whatever it is, you've got it. It's like the Beatles, blah, blah, blah." And so basically he pegs Brian Jones as a bullshit artist from the get-go. And the next major development after they do sign the Stones to a recording contract, and then they sign a deal between their production company and Decca Records. And this was an easy opportunity because Decca Records was headed by Dick Rowe, who became famous as the man who turned down the Beatles because they signed Brian Poole and the Tremolos after they'd auditioned the Beatles the same day and ended up, you know, making one of the most famous mistakes in show business history and letting the Beatles go down the road to EMI. And so Dick Rowe was very eager basically to sign anything that looked like a rock group at this point. And he signed the Stones. And there was a little bit of drama when the Eastman and Oldham produced the Stones' first single, Come On. Neither of them really knew what they were doing as producers. And Glenn Johns, the engineer, wouldn't have anything to do with them because he'd just been screwed out of his deal with the Stones. So they were kind of on their own, produced a version of Come On. Depending on the Stones, to you know, the mandate was pick your five most commercial songs and we'll pick which one to record. And Come On was the Chuck Berry song that hadn't been released in the UK. So the Stones picked that. Anyway, there was a little bit of drama where Decca originally refused the recording and did a re-recording in their own studios. But ultimately, they decided to go with the Oldham-produced version, and the licensing deal was off and running. And the rest of the Stones' career, they would always produce and own their own masters and license them to record companies. But then a key moment happens when the Rolling Stones audition for BBC Radio. And this, at this time, there was strict musician union regulations that limited the number of records that the BBC could play on the radio. They had to balance it out with live music by union member musicians. And so there was a big demand for live music on the BBC, and the Beatles' famous BBC sessions are the result of this. And this is why we, you know, have BBC session albums by the Stones and the Kinks and et cetera. But initially, the Stones failed their audition with the BBC. They were described as too black. This Mick Jagger was too black and not a strong singer. And there's accounts in other books of Brian Jones actually crying when he got that news and was totally shattered. And in this book, Oldham says that Ian Stewart was in the office, Oldman and Eastman's office, and overheard a conversation between Brian Jones and Eric Eastman. And this is another classic Brian Jones mistake, was that he saw Eric Eastman as the leading partner rather than Andrew Oldham. And so he cozied up to Eastman while Mick and Keith were cozying up to Oldham. But after they failed the audition, then Brian and Eastman are talking and said, due to union rules, blah, 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 Easton, cigarette permanently in his gob and a suit that matched the color of the ash, was anxious that the Rolling Stones should pass BBC muster. I ashened in demeanor when Eric suggested we might have to sack Mick Jagger. If they did not appear on nationally popular BBC radio shows like Saturday Club, the Stones single was certain to be rejected as well. On the subject of Mick's adequacy as a vocalist, Brian and Eric had already had a summit powwow. Oh God, how fast we all become experts. And decided that nothing should be allowed to get in the way of this, quote, great opportunity, including Mick. Ian Stewart, who overheard the conversation, told us that Brian agreed with Easton, noting that Jagger always had a weak voice and, quote, has to be careful if he wants to sing night after night. We'll just have to get rid of him if necessary. And so this was, you know, Marianne Faithfull told how the Stones had a vendetta against Brian Jones, and you know, there's various theories as to why. Anita Pallenberg chalked it up to sexual politics, and we might get into that into a future episode. But I think this is pretty obviously the point. I mean, Keith Richards has made a big deal about how the Stones felt betrayed when they found out Brian was getting an extra 5 pounds a week. But something tells me that Mick Jagger never got over this betrayal. And it's also very telling that Ian Stewart was the source of the information, as we're about to find out what happens to Ian Stewart. And Oldham tells how he handled this crisis. He says, back at the offices of Impact Sound, Eric had not thought it through and backed off when I snarled, "So Brian sings?" I'd already heard Jones's backing vocal attempts, and the Big Bopper could rest in peace. Easton, in what would become his familiar line of attack, accused me of, quote, caring too much, suggesting I was too influenced by one of the guitars and the vocal refrain. And so, Oldham managed to shut that down. But Brian was never going to be forgiven for that. And then the next big betrayal that happens is that Steph tells me it's time to cue again. So let's hear another Jagger Richards song that Oldham placed with another artist and produced. This is Vashti Bunyan, who's gone on to become kind of a cult favorite, or did at least in the 90s and 2000s when her work was rediscovered. And this is her doing Jagger and Richards' Some Things Just Stick in Your Mind, produced by Andrew Lou Oldham. And that was Vashti Bunyan doing Some Things Just Stick in Your Mind, written by Jagger and Richards, and produced by Andrew Oldham. Actually, it was Jagger Richard, because Andrew changed Keith's name to Richard because of Cliff Richard. So for 10 years, Keith Richard Richards was Keith Richard, but he's come back. So people usually forget about that. But before we get to the firing of Ian Stewart, Oldham's got a quote that is pretty classic as to his attitude about how stars have to handle business. He says, "Stars must be killers, always striking first and last. They have to be so totally obsessed and paranoid about this year's vision of themselves that it's beyond obsession. It's reality, logical and natural. There's no remorse when they kill, no regrets when they pimp, and no shame when they whore. And it's really a fair exchange. The world needs them and they need the world. A star is a star is a star, and a fixed race would be nice if you could arrange it." And so that sums up his attitude and his politics, and kind of explains how he was able to be so merciless to the very kind and sweet Ian Stewart. And he's got a quote, a good section from Felge again. And I read part of this when he did the Nankering with the Stones, but I left out some key parts. Feld says, "I was in the lounge of the flat I shared with Brian, Keith, and Mick. When Brian and Keith entered the room, both looking tense, seeing their faces, I asked Keith, 'What's up?' 'We have to tell Stewie's out of the band,' said Keith, who looked very unhappy. 'You're kidding,' I replied, shocked. 'Why?' 'Andrew doesn't think he can do anything with the way Stu looks.' I knew, of course, what that meant and visualized Stu's face with its prominent chin. Stu dressed differently as well. 'What are you going to tell him?' I asked. 'Surely they're not going to tell Stu that directly.' It looked difficult. 'We don't know yet,' said Brian. 'We don't know how he's going to take it or how to tell him.' Andrew said that Stu could stay on as road manager or something. It's just the image thing." And then I did tell the rest of the story about how they tell Stewie's out of the band, and they did it by one day they show up and everybody's got uniforms and there's only 5 uniforms. They didn't bother to buy a uniform for Stu. And so then he asks, "Where's my uniform?" And they tell him he's out of the band. And then that's when Brian makes his fatal mistake by making Stu a bunch of empty promises that he's going to have a sixth of everything. And so this, of course, when Stu later overhears Brian talking about getting rid of Mick, explains why he was so eager to let people know what Brian was up to. But there's also this little touching thing. He said, Felge goes up to Stu afterwards and he says, "I'm sorry to hear about this, Stu," I offered genuinely. He took his hands from his pockets and turned his palms limply outwards as a token of hopelessness. "I expected something like this might happen." He sounded upset and said it so soundly. I looked at him and thought he was going to cry. If I hadn't been in the room, I'm sure he would have done so. So that's the firing of the one good guy in the band. Good person, I mean. And then the next big story that Oldham tells is that after the first single, they're desperately flailing for a song choice. And because the Stones had gone up north to Liverpool and played the Cavern with the Hollies from Manchester and been blown away by their harmonies and their versions of Lieber and Stoller songs, Brian thought that covering a Lieber and Stoller song like Fortune Teller would be just the ticket. But that wasn't working. Oldham knew it wasn't working, and he fled the rehearsal space they were in to walk around the streets of London that one afternoon. And fatefully, a big limo pulls up and sees him on the sidewalk and stops and says, "Hey, Andrew, what's got you down?" And it's John Lennon and Paul McCartney that knew Oldham from when he had done press work for him a few months earlier. And he tells him, "Hey, you know, we're trying to record a second single for the Stones and they don't have anything. And do you guys have any songs?" And John and Paul, of course, the cash register rings and immediately they're like, "Well, we might have something." And they go back to the Stones rehearsal space with Andrew. And so Andrew Oldham walks in with John Lennon and Paul McCartney and says, "Hey, guys, the Beatles have a song for you. And so that's where I Want to Be Your Man comes into the picture." And it wasn't finished. And the Stones got to see them finish the song. Brian Jones is immediately lit on fire, adds a killer slide guitar part. And then Oldham is actually so over, he's totally bipolar. And he's so elated at this that then he immediately plunges into a terrible depression and has to fly to Paris for the weekend while the Stones record that song without him. which is why Brian Jones basically got to produce the Stones' second single on their own. I talked about that on the Jimmy Felds episode. And then there's this couple quotes on Oldham's relationship with Mick Jagger around this time that are pretty telling. He says, he talks about how he ends up moving out of his mother's house because she's mad at him for never being home. And he and Keith and Mick get an apartment together. Brian moves in with Linda Lawrence and everybody abandons Edith Grove. And he says, now there was no distance to complain of. And three of the Rolling Stones' leading lights beamed as one. I talked to Mick and Keith listened, though on occasions Mick had begun to confide in me in a manner that would have given Keith only amusement. Mick and I were as close for a while as two young men could probably become. These days, I enjoy the same with my dog. I love my dog. We have the same goal in mind, her food and my love. Substitute what it was that Mick was looking for, and you'll find between us as fair an exchange. I gave him what he wanted and got what I decided I'd needed. And then there's a quote from Tony King, who was a London scenester at the time, and he says, Andrew and Mick's relationship was always very volatile. Somewhere along the line, something didn't go right, and it's not something that's ever been mended. Maybe they'll both get older and calmer, bump into each other in an airport, sit down, and be able to have a good laugh about it all. Artists will always survive. The ones that stay at the top are tough. There's a lot of bodies littered along the way to their success. That's why they are where they are. Mick, Elton, Barbara Streisand, Diana Ross, they move right along. If you look at the managers of that period, Brian Epstein died. Kit Lambert died. That was the manager of The Who. Peter Grant died. That was the manager of Led Zeppelin. And Robert Stigwood ended up as a recluse on the Isle of Wight. Stigwood managed the Bee Gees and Eric Clapton. They were all sensitive guys who found it very hard to cope with enormous success and flipped out. And then Tony King has another great quote about the band. He says, Andrew, Mick, and Keith were like a three-headed monster. They were always together. And that's parallels. The Beatles were frequently called a four-headed monster around this time. Andrew and Charlie Watts were close. Bill had nothing to interest him, nor did Ian Stewart. Brian Jones was a cunt, very difficult for anybody to get on with, a fallen angel with a golden halo surrounding an angelic face, but the soul of the devil. So another ringing endorsement of Brian Jones. And the last piece of the book that I want to talk about is the songwriting of the Stones. And Keith Richards quote that Andrew literally forced us to write songs. And there's the famous story about Andrew leaving for the evening one day and locking Keith and Mick in and saying, I'm not going to let you out until you've got a song. And when he came back, they did have a song, and we've already played it. Gene Pitney's version of it anyway. But this is the Andrew Luke Oldham Orchestra doing a version of the Stones' The Last Time from 1965. And that was the Andrew Luke Oldham Orchestra doing an acoustic instrumental version of The Last Time. And you'll probably recognize it because it's the key hook of the Verve's Bittersweet Symphony. And that's a whole nother story. But that's the Verve wanted to sample that for their song and went to Oldham and got permission. And then later, Alan Klein and Jagger and Richards found out about it and sued the Verve and got Jagger and Richards the complete songwriting credits for that song, even though they'd done nothing. And it was just a sample that was used, that was based on a song called The Last Time, which they plagiarized from the Staple Singers, and Brian Jones wrote the riff, which was the only original element. Not quite the only original element. They added a new, they changed the chord structure up. But anyway, Oldham had realized immediately that publishing was where the money was in the music business, and that the Stones would be dependent on outside writers if they didn't have an in-house writing team. And so he pushed them and pushed them, and they had to work at it for quite a while. It was several months before they wrote a song that passed muster with Brian Jones and the rest of the Stones. If when they brought in their early ballads, to Brian and the rest of the band, he would just mercilessly crucify them for daring to present the Stones with inappropriate material. Of course, later on, the tables would turn. And then there's a few, he also discusses that Brian Jones wanted to be a songwriter, and Jones didn't have the confidence or the relationship to present his songs to Oldham. They were oil and water, never gotten along. And he, as Felge related, and I didn't get into this when I talk about that book, but at one point Brian did write a song very early on with lyrics and everything and tried to force Mick to sing it. And Mick and Keith just laughed him out of the room. And I think that was probably a fatal blow to his confidence. Many other people who knew Brian and worked with him. In fact, Gene Clark of the Byrds wanted to give him co-writing credit for the song 8 Miles High, that plenty of people thought Brian had the talent to have been a songwriter, or at least contributing member of a songwriting team. But he was, because of these personal dynamics, he was locked out of this. And in fairness, Oldham did have Gene Pitney spend some time with Brian and see, he was like, can you just spend some time with him and hear what he's working on and let me know, is there anything there? And Oldham's takeaway was that Pitney came back and said, no, there's nothing there. There's no point, no songwriting talent whatsoever. Pitney's account of it is that Brian was too freaked out and nervous to even play him anything. So, be that as it may. But there's a couple more quotes to wrap up about Oldham's influence on the Stones and his, that I think are worth reading. This is from Andy Wipeout Wiggum, who was one of Oldham's right-hand men and became a legendary figure in the music business on his own right, working for Warner Brothers in the 70s. But he says, though the Stones clearly had something special, their personality and attitude owed everything to the turbulence of their mentor, Andrew. When I went to Ilpi Island, what I saw was an efficient blues group with a charismatic singer with good James Brown moves, but nothing all that different from, say, the Yardbirds or the Pretty Things. Andrew used them as a conduit for his angst and thus created the first group with a seriously antisocial stance, irritating the Beatles in the process. In a famous interview, John Lennon castigated the Stones for plagiarism, but was unable to disguise his envy of their sinful image in contrast to the bourgeois foolery of his own crew. And then there's an interesting thing where Oldham talks about his relationship with John Lennon. He says, John was so very attuned to the notion that if the music business was bollocks, it would be his bollocks. And so you never lied to Johnny Lennon. He was very fast with an opinion, and it scared a lot of those he wished to scare. I'm looking through you is what John Lennon did. He invited you to walk on eggshells. His directness always brought me back to myself, and he appreciated that my life and agenda were not about Alfie. He's referring to the Michael Caine movie Alfie. We were all so good at publicity that when John said as he might, the Beatles are bigger than Jesus, I'm sure he meant that. Should the good public wish to slander him in his way of life, they might consider that he was as close to a man of integrity as their offspring were likely to get. It's really one of the most elegant remarks anybody has ever excited the press's hemorrhoids over. In John Lennon's highly sensitive presence, you knew exactly who you were, and that is quite a gift to be hauling around. So pretty interesting insight from Lennon. And then the final bit is the genesis of the famous slogan, would you let your daughter marry a Rolling Stone? And Oldham tells how he came up with the basic gist, and then Fleet Street reporters ran with it and ran wild. And next time we'll come back and we'll talk about Two Stone, which is the sequel to this memoir where Oldham describes the Stones' adventures in America and his work with the Small Faces and at Impact Records. So I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and today's book has been Stoned, A Memoir of London in the 1960s by Andrew Lugg Oldham. So thanks, Andrew. Sorry we couldn't have you on the show.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Monday, Nate welcomes back Brooks Long to discuss the autobiography of Grandmaster Flash. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.